Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 19.
Strong start, Alexi, with a
Sorry. Well, it's the internet. I'll start again. Or are you going to keep the... Hello, hey, everybody. Hey, welcome to the morning crew on Alexi Sale podcast. Today we've got the bulldozer. Hey, bulldozer. Hi, Alexi. We got Ratface.
Hi, Alexi.
We got the whole crew here. Woo, woo, woo.
Bah, bah, bah.
I used to do the Steve Wright show, and the first thing you would, I don't know if you can say this really, but you'd come into the studio and you'd scream at how fat he got. And then after that, you'd have to, you know, you'd have to plug whatever nonsense you were plugging, really. Anyway, today we've got a guest who makes us all look bad, really, whose moral courage and physical and moral courage, I guess. And is that a dog in the background?
It is. He's just got on the bed.
Dr. Victoria Rose, recently back from Gaza, plastic surgeon. And, I guess, tell us about yourself, really. But you are the embodiment of a living saint. I've got this pain in my shoulder, which we could talk about later.
We could talk about later. So I'm a plastic surgeon. If I've actually been a doctor this August for 30 years, so I'm feeling a bit old now. So I think most people think when I say I'm a plastic surgeon that I do tit jobs and facelifts, but actually the bulk of plastic surgery that we do, particularly in the NHS, is reconstruction, and that's what we've been doing in Gaza. And I've sort of been involved with a very small charity called Ideals for a very long time. And they've been going to Gaza for a very long time. But since the war started, or since this war started, the charity registered itself as an emergency medical team. And I've been on 3 trips back to Gaza with them to try and do some reconstruction surgery.
I mean, how physically does that work? I mean, what is the process by which you actually go there? I mean, where do you fly to?
So before they took the Rafah border, it was really nice. We used to fly to Cairo, and you could hire your own minibus and you could fill it with whatever you could fit in it. And then you would join the United Nations convoy of minibuses. So all the charities would have 1 or 2 minibuses, and we'd all drive down through the Sinai Desert to the Rafah border, and then you'd get all your bags out. There's always a bit of waiting around at the Egyptian side just to do all the passport checks. But once you were through, and then one of our colleagues in Gaza would pick us up and take us and all the baggage to whichever hospital we were working at. And it was really, compared to what's happened since, it was really easy and very nice. And we managed to get a lot of kit to them. And then in the May of 24, Israel took Rafah and closed that border. So then you had to enter through Israel, which meant that you had to apply to the United Nations to get a seat on a bus now. So there was one bus that went in on a Tuesday and a Thursday, and one that came out. And there were 25 seats on the bus. So you would apply for a seat, or the charity would apply for our seats. And they would be told about 2 weeks before that we had a seat. And then we'd all fly to Amman. And the night before we were due to leave, we'd get approval as to whether or not COGAT would let us in. And if COGAT said you could come in, you were then allowed to make your way to the bus pickup spot at the Seventh Circle in Amman. You're only allowed to take one bag with you. It's 23 kilos. You're not allowed to take any medical equipment. You're only allowed to take one mobile phone, one laptop, one iPad. And then you've got to have your own place to stay when you get there. You're not allowed to stay at the hospitals. You've got to have your own driver 24/7 in case you need to evacuate. You've got to have your own sat phone and your own Garmin. So they brought in all of these ridiculous rules, and you've got to stay there for a month. You're not allowed to go in for under a month. So it sort of started to become really difficult for us to go, but we carried on. And then you get from Amman to the King Hussein Bridge, or the Jordanian crossing, the Allenby Bridge, and then you get off. Yeah, you get off. All your bags are checked by the Jordan officials. Then you get back on the bus and you drive a couple of hundred meters. Then you get off the bus. All your bags are taken off you by the Israeli customs guys. And then there's a lot of waiting around. Eventually you get your bags back. And then you get on the Israeli bus. And it's a three-hour journey all the way through Israel, right down to, I mean, virtually down to Egypt you're driving, to cross at a point called Kerem Shalom, which is it is basically next door to Rafah. You're not allowed to get off the bus at all because you don't have a visa for Israel, because they won't give you one if you're going to Gaza. So there's a police escort in front of you and a Koga escort behind to make sure you don't get off the bus. Then when you get to Kerem Shalom, you're decanted into a UN armoured vehicle. So about seven UN armoured vehicles come and pick you up. You get all your crap off the bus, put it in the armoured vehicles. You get a stab vest and a tin hat. You get in the UN vehicle and they drive you through the border to Derabella, which is sort of mid-level Gaza. And that's where OCHA has its training centre, and you're all deposited there. And then your respective teams pick you up from there and take you to whichever hospital you're going to.
I mean, people have often talked about, MAP is the main medical charity that I work with, obviously. But they've talked about, they used to talk about the vitality and the, just that even though despite the oppression, the wonderful energy that you found in Gaza. I mean, it's those names, isn't it? Like saying Rafah or, Deir al-Balah or, Jabhat. They're just different piles of rubble, aren't they, really, that you're referring to? No, they're not places with distinct identity.
No. No, Deir al-Balah's held on to a bit more of its infrastructure, I think, just because, but that's just because a lot of the UN, well, the UN officers were there. So that's where OCHA is. That's where UNRWA were. MSF have got a big base there. And I think it's been harder for Israel to hit that.
Yeah.
But the rest of it is rubble. I mean, when we first went in the March, it was bad. But when we went in the August, the difference was striking. I mean, it was like something out of a film, like going across the surface of the moon. We didn't see any sign of life or a single building for about 15 minutes as we drove up the Saladin Road. And that road we'd driven in the March, and there'd been people running around, and some of the farms were still, trying to work. So what's happened in that time frame is just incredible. I mean, it's 70% of every part of their infrastructure has been razed to the ground.
Yeah. And sorry, I'm just going to shut the cat off.
Hello, Wilf.
Hello, Fletch.
Both of you having creatures. And I've got a builder next door hammering like on the wall behind me.
This is
it's
not,
all kicking off here.
This is not legacy media. Could you see I didn't have my trousers on either? So.
I missed that.
I missed it too.
I've got underpants on.
It's really hot, isn't it, in London now?
In the UK? I mean, we're in the basement, so it's relatively cool, but yes, it was really hot yesterday. I don't know how much you, because I know health, NHS workers have been constrained with that. UK liars for Israel are very keen on
they've taken one of my friends to court. They reported him to the GMC on a really amazing claim from a woman who was Jewish, who said that she, although she'd never met him or been treated by him, she felt that if she had to be treated by him, he would be anti-Semitic. And that actually made it, because if you refer one of us to the GMC, they have to look into it.
Yes.
So he actually got that sort of, there's a GMC inquiry against you. Yeah. He had to get all of us to write statements about his character to support him. You know, it's just hassle. I mean, although we all knew it wasn't going to go anywhere, as you said, it's just the...
It ties people just, up. I mean, they do that with MAP as well, you know.
Yeah, you've just got more bureaucracy to deal with. Yeah. So. And then they reported him to the Charity Commission as well. So that was, you know, another...
Yeah, I know they are under investigation. I mean, the Charity Commission will be...
I hope they're under investigation.
Yeah, they are, but, you know, whether anything will come of it is highly unlikely. I mean, they are the most... evil people in many ways, I think. Poisonous group of monsters.
I know, it's amazing. It's amazing that they get funding to do what they do, but
not really amazing when you think of what the you know, what the project is. I suppose we'll get down to the specific. The eradication of Gaza is part of a... It's a project. I mean, it's the end goal is to either kill everybody or drive them out of Gaza, don't you think? I mean, I don't know if you...
That certainly seems to be what they're doing. And I think now quite a few of them have actually come out in you know, national publications and TV and other media outlets and said that. I don't know whether you saw that article by that woman in The Guardian, and she picked up 20 bits of media where one or other of high government figures in Israel had said that they wanted, you know, not a single life left in Gaza.
Right.
They wanted all of them dead. And she stopped after 20 because she said she, you know, got another job to do. But
there was even that one who said, just like Hitler wanted to do with the Jews, and eradicate the Jews. We want to clear Gaza of all Muslims. It's like comparing their action directly to Hitler. And it's like, dude, you make it, you know, making the Hitler comparison is such a cheap thing, but you make it so fucking, you put it there like that.
So her name was Awa Madawi, and she published it in the Guardian. And there were things in there like, you know, a place where no human being can exist, and flatten everything in Gaza just like Auschwitz.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's very difficult to now say that they're not, that's not their intention.
Yeah.
Because they've sort of let the cat out of the bag.
Yeah. I mean, what to go back to the start then, what propelled you to, I mean, your job must be difficult enough as it is, really. What propelled you to then go to a war zone? Is it more difficult?
It wasn't. When I first went, it was 2018, so it wasn't really a war zone. And I went really to help my orthopaedic colleagues, because I work, the team that I go with, so Graham, who's the guy that I go with, I work with him in the NHS. We work at King's College together. And he's been going since, you know, 2009, trying to train local Gazan doctors, orthopedic techniques. And the issue that the doctors in Gaza have got is because of the way they're occupied or have been occupied, most of them, when they apply for permits, most of the doctors, when they apply for a permit to leave Gaza to come to, say, England for a conference or a training course, it gets denied. And so to put that in perspective, in the UK, all of our plastic surgeons have to go to international meetings as part of their training. It's one of the things that they won't accredit. They won't be able to take a consultant's post unless they show that they've had this continual professional development. And that will involve going either abroad for a period of time to train in another country or engaging in international meetings. And obviously, Israel stopped the Gazan doctors doing that. So it kind of stunted their ability to sort of grow their healthcare service. So Graham's main aim was to try and combat that. And he actually managed to get two of them back to the UK to train with us. And then he started sending us there to train them. And I went to start a plastics training program. So that was what I was trying to do. And I got a Gazan surgeon to come back to the UK and train with me. And he was with me for 2 years. And so consequently, you become good friends. You know, I know his wife and his kids. They've been round to my house. My other half knows them really well. You know, he's cooked them dinner. And then suddenly you've got someone very, you've got a real personal face on it. And so when the war started, we were still in touch. And up until that point, he'd been sending me pictures of difficult operations that he was thinking of doing. And we were looking at them at King's and giving him some advice. And then suddenly in the October, the pictures were, you know, little kids where he's saying to me, I don't know what to do other than amputate this 7-year-old's leg. And I was like, oh, my God, you know, he's just become the consultant level. He's got no one else really out there because he's the only plastic surgeon. So I said to Philip, my other half, you know, in the kitchen, I think I'm going to have to go to Gaza and give Ahmed a hand. And there was a moment of, don't be so fucking stupid, but then there was a moment of he could actually see that, although that was really stupid, that that was needed. You know, they all resisted it a lot when we first went back in the March, but I think it was very hard for them. They'd all met him. It was very hard for them to say, you can't go. And then obviously when we get out there and they can see what we're doing, it makes it even, you know, even more compelling to go back.
And so, I mean, so it's how many times? You've been there three times.
Three times, yeah.
And you've seen a particularly precipitate kind of...
Yeah, I mean, it's just got worse and worse. Every time I leave, I keep it. I think it can't get any worse. And I said that when we left in June, oh, it can't get any worse. And then they cut the internet, and I was like, "Geez, I didn't even think they could do that." But of course, they can do that.
So. Yeah, they can do whatever they want. Really.
Yeah. So I mean, it is. I'm, you know, we're due to go back in October, and I keep hoping that we've had some sort of change in the state of play by then, but. Because if we haven't, I can't imagine what it's going to be like.
No. So, I mean, what is your day-to-day activity then when you are there?
So we have been based for the last two times at the NASA Medical Complex. We were supposed to be at the European Gaza in May when we went back, but on the day that we got there, they started bombing it, so... So that sort of scuppered our plans and we decanted to NASA. But NASA's got sort of a theatre, or it's got two theatres that are dedicated to orthopaedic and plastics, and they're next to each other on the ground floor, and we normally go and take those over. And the way that we work is we do work really closely with MAP because we were partnered with them before the war. We used to be their sort of surgical arm. They supported our projects. Funded a lot of it actually. And so we often team up with the MAP surgeons so that we've got a couple of orthopedic surgeons, plastic surgeons, and an anaesthetist so that we can run the theatre. And we normally go to NASA and set up there and just run a theatre nonstop from the moment we get there until the moment we leave. And then our Palestinian colleagues sort of join us. So the nurses that we've worked with for years will come and work with us and other doctors that we've known come and work with us. And we just get through the backlog, really. Whoever they've got in the hospital, we see. Whoever comes in through accident emergency, we see. And we just try and get through as much as we can. Last time we were doing about 13 cases each a day, 10 to 13.
Like surgeries?
Yeah, yeah.
And you've got dwindling... supplies and resources.
Yeah, I mean, it was tricky. I mean, I'm not going to last. It was a bit like scrap heap challenge for most of it. But you can't not sort of keep going. And, you know, bits and pieces filter through to you in drips and drabs. So you know what we haven't got and what we have got. And you sort of try and be as frugal as you can. But a lot of it is getting them into a sort of clean environment, trying to get the wounds clean. It's that sort of thing. And then, you know, fixing bones and trying to reconstruct the skin. But it is getting harder and harder. We've got, when we left in the in June, we had no analgesia. So we had this terrible situation where we would operate on people and then you'd take them into the recovery area and just have to listen to them screaming in pain because we didn't have any painkillers. And that's hard when it's kids. That's really hard when it's kids. I'd say more than 50% of the list was kids. The first six people, it was done in age order. So the first six would be under the age of 14 every day, and none of them had any painkiller. And then we started to run out of antibiotics and intravenous saline, just sort of stuff that you would never imagine you couldn't source in a hospital. But we had no supplies from the 2nd of March right the way through that May. Not a single truck of equipment got to us. And then at the beginning of June, MSF got two trucks of medical equipment in, and some of it came to NASA.
And this is, you know, entirely the Israelis are stopping these trucks. It's not to do with
Hamas. Yeah, no.
That, it's entirely lies.
Yeah, I think they need to show the evidence that it is Hamas, because we never saw that the trucks being looted, and I don't think they've provided the evidence for it. But there certainly was a gang that had apparently been paid by the Israelis that Hamas were regularly fighting, and you could hear that going on around the hospital. So there was a gang trying to disrupt what we were doing, and you could hear Hamas having a go at them, but you never really saw it. And they certainly, you know, didn't take any trucks of equipment.
No,
so it's a difficult narrative.
Yeah, it's all lies. I mean, how do you feel? I mean, do you feel better for having done something? I mean, because one of the things I think that we suffer from is just this feeling of impotence, really.
Yes. Yeah, I suppose I do feel like I've done something, but then you have that horrible survivor's guilt where you haven't done enough. You know, it's all very well for me to swan in and knock out a couple of surgeries, but then to be able to leave them all behind is really hard.
And that it must actually be a very poignant moment when you say goodbye to them.
It's awful, and you just don't know whether you're going to see them again, and that's the hardest thing. And we've lost some really close friends. So Adnan Birch, who was the orthopaedic surgeon that's featured in the film that the BBC didn't show, he was a really old colleague of ours. We'd all worked with him, and he was one of the surgeons that came to the UK to train with us. So that was really hard when he died. And Mohammed Abaid again has been disappeared. He's in the film as well.
Yeah.
And we've lobbied the government so much to try and get them to find him, because we believe that he is in prison in Israel. But that's the hardest bit. And now I've got a whole host of, you know, nurses that every time I go back, it's sort of finding out, you know, where they are, if they're safe, and what they're doing.
I mean, how do you feel? Can you speak about your feelings of the UK government, for example? I mean,
I cannot believe that we can stand by and not do anything about it. I find it incredible that we have a prime minister who is a humanitarian lawyer. So a human rights lawyer who has Jewish family, who is in a privileged position to be able to do something about this and at the same time have, you know, the ear and the protection of the UK Jewish population. And he doesn't.
Yeah.
And he doesn't.
He's not gonna do anything, is he, really? I think, given his who's funding him and who's, you know, where his ideology for what, I mean, whoever the hell he is, I don't quite know, you know.
No, it is difficult, and I know, you know, whoever's funding him is funding him, but I do think at some point even the people that are funding him have got to look at what's happening and realise it's not right. It doesn't matter what you want from this as your political objective. If you want them to leave Israel or Palestine, this is not the right way of doing it. And I, you know, the whole world is watching those people fund this. So I, at some point, you know, even the Israeli lobby's got to agree that it's not a good look for them. They are looking very Nazi Germany.
Yes, well, I agree, but I don't know if they care really. I mean, what do you have any? I mean, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, you got any predictions?
I do think that we are going to. I think if we carry on with the pressure that we're putting on all the respective governments, and as charities, you know, MAP and Ideals have been across Europe this summer speaking to the foreign ministers from Spain, Germany and from France, and we've been to Geneva and to the United Nations. And I do feel that if we can keep the pressure up across Europe, we could start a sort of European sanctions against them. We know what hurt them, and that was sanctioning Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. And as we've said, there is another, you know, 20 or so high-ranking Israeli officials that could have sanctions brought against them for things that they've done and said, you know, just on the human rights issue and international, you know, breaches in international law. And if we all did that as Europe, I think that would send a massive message. And I'm sure that once one country goes, and you saw it with the recognizing Palestine, although that was lip service, that's a lot further than we've ever got before. And France went, UK went. So we're definitely moving in the right direction. And my view is if we could all take more action as Europe, then that just leaves Mr. Trump and Israel, and whatever you think of him, you know, he's very erratic, and he is a businessman, and you can see it now in America that lots of those politicians are saying, we don't want our tax dollars funding somebody else's war, and that is coming. Even Fox News are giving airtime to some of the sort of politicians who are saying that. You know, they've got huge problems with housing and unemployment. What are they doing funding a war for Israel? And I just think if Europe went and he's left on his own with Israel, the finances are really going to start to become an issue for him. And he won't, you know what he's like. He doesn't like being told what to do. So the more AIPAC and, the lobby are on him, the more likely he is to just go, no, I'm running this.
Inshallah, let's hope so. I mean, do you have much to do with the individual Israelis? Do you have,
No, we don't really. We've not really managed to get any audience with any of them. We did work quite closely with a mediation group that were trying to sort of put forward some peace talks, and they involved us in their talks about rebuilding the healthcare infrastructure in Gaza if there was a ceasefire. But we never really got to talk to any high-ranking Israeli officials.
No.
We've got some friends. Obviously, we've made lots of friends in the media now because we are, you know, giving them the information that they can't get. Right. So we have some colleagues in Israel that write for Israeli news outlets. So quite a few of us have worked with Haaretz, who have been amazing.
And some
other publications have picked up on things that we've said and interviewed us. So that's probably been our closest contact to your average Israeli, really.
How do they? I mean, but these are small outliers, aren't they, in terms of the Israeli population?
They are, but again, they are getting some traction. I mean, I don't know whether you saw the news that showed a huge number of Israelis demonstrating at one of the crossings, trying to get in to give aid to the Gazans.
Really? No.
Yeah. So that has recently.
They weren't trying to block aid, because there's quite a few.
No, they weren't trying to block aid. They were trying to get in to give aid. So there are sort of small pockets, and you know, it's amazing to think how close Tel Aviv is to Gaza.
Yeah.
And that life goes on normally there. And I think it's a bit, it is becoming it is, I think it is becoming uncomfortable for them in the way that the world is ostracizing right. them.
Yeah. Well, let's hope so. Let's do more of all that, really. I mean, it is one of the only ways that we can. I mean, they still have, unfortunately, they still have all their bought and paid for advocates, but it is the, you know, all these monsters in our government. But, yeah, it is something we can do. It's not, you know, obviously boycott Israel, boycott, and also, you know, campaign in any way that we find possible. So are you planning to go back? Or I mean, what you said?
We've got ourselves booked for another mission in October. Obviously, the charity sends a mission every month now. So our team leaves on the 28th of August. And then we've got another team that will do September, and my name's down for the October mission. But it's difficult because, as we said, the final decision on who gets in goes to Israel. So they vet that list. And obviously, you know, myself and Graham, who I go with, have probably been more visible than we've ever been before.
Yeah.
And I'm under no illusions that I'm likely to get a denial or a ban. Well, and quite a few doctors have been banned and denied now. So it is, you know, it is worrying. I think the WHO have said it's approaching 50% of all doctors that apply get denied.
How does it affect your life back here? I mean, do you?
I'm pretty lucky at the moment because the trust that I work for have been very good. I have to take annual leave to go, but they have been very good. And we sort of arranged that they will let me arrange things so that it has, you know, minimum impact on the service that we're running here. So we'll, you know, front load everything and then catch everything up when I get back. So it's always a killer because you're working really hard before you go to get everyone seen and done. And then you go and you've got this 4 weeks of carnage out there. And then when you come back, you've got to deal with, you know, everybody that has been waiting to sort of be seen. So it is tiring. It's very, very tiring. But everybody, you know.
Do you ever end up resenting your NHS patients who are like, complaining because they've waited too long for an appointment? You're like, mate, I've just been to fucking Gaza where there's no anesthetic, and
it's nice it is really nice to come home and see other problems that you can sort out. It is very, I do a lot of breast cancer reconstruction, and it is really nice to come home and actually be able to do something well with all the equipment, and it is good. So no, I don't really see that. That all the patients say it to me though. Oh, I feel really bad coming in moaning about this.
That's nice. Ah.
you do hear obviously that, oh God, it just makes you want to weep just thinking about how restricted and how few supplies you have out there and what you're forced to do in terms of surgeries, and that you would never, you know, wish on it on your enemy, like to do the operations in those circumstances. But has those circumstances led to any kind of innovation, or like has new ways of doing things because of these constraints come about from it that could help people in the future in war zones and stuff? Has anything
I think what I have realized is how much we waste in the UK on once single use only items. And we probably ought to look a bit more at reusing single-use items, because that is what we were doing in Gaza. Those items definitely have a lifespan on them. They're not designed to be used forever, but most of them can be used more than once. And I think that was probably what was the most interesting for us when we were there. So things like the masks that they, or the tubes that they put into your throat when they give you a general anaesthetic. There's one called a laryngeal mask, which sort of holds your airway open, goes in the mouth. And in the UK, we throw that away. We use it once and we throw that away. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Gaza, they would put that through sterilization. So that would go into an autoclave and be used again. And then it would go into a disinfectant and would use those multiple times. There's other sort of bits and pieces, some of the surgical equipment that we throw away in the UK, they were re-sterilizing and getting another two or three uses out of it. And I suppose, you know, you think in this day and age, with all the problems we've got with plastics and waste and, you know, climate issues, the health service is hugely responsible for creating an enormous amount of stuff that goes to landfill. And lots of our anaesthetists in the UK have been pushing to, you know, to reuse things. So I work with an anaesthetist in London, and she will use one syringe for one patient. So when she puts you to sleep, she'll draw every single drug that you need with a single 10 mil syringe.
Oh.
So whereas everybody else will open another syringe for each drug that they give you.
Yeah.
So they give you some paracetamol, that will be in one 10 mil syringe. They'll give you the fentanyl, that will be in another one. She won't do that. She'll just use one.
It is mad.
And it is things like that that make you think, well, that is probably a good thing to be doing in the UK, and that they are certainly doing that in Gaza, because they wouldn't dream of opening all that equipment for one patient.
Why do we have that culture just on this slight off chance that someone doesn't sterilize it properly and they don't want to get sued?
I think there is that sort of culture of, you know, best practice and infection prevention and, you know, all of that protective, you know, sort of mentality around it. And that's what's driven it. Definitely infection prevention has driven that. But there are ways of reusing those items and still maintaining antiseptic techniques.
Yeah.
And just finally, I mean, if I needed it, could you do me a new face?
You don't need it.
Well, I'm by my, you know, that's very kind of you to say. That just might be for legal reasons, you know. I might need to, if I need to disappear. Well.
Yeah, if you need to disappear, yeah, definitely come and see me.
Yeah, I'll come and see you, and you could redo
we'll
me as
out.
A yeah. Good to know. Well, it's, you know, all this stuff. You know, I've got to have a, you know, got a solicitor on board. You know, just in case. Now these days, I might as well have a plastic surgeon as well.
Definitely, definitely not a problem.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to are millions of viewers in the Philippines?
No, I suppose the only thing that I wanted to ask you is how much backlash have you got? Because you're Jewish, aren't you?
Well, my mother was Jewish. I think I'm in a really privileged position in a way. I mean, I've consistently always supported Palestine. I was a founder member, I think, of MAP back in the day. And so it's part of my brand, as it were, that I speak out for Palestine, I think. And I don't care about it. I'm also not on social media, so I don't see, presumably, there is a lot of vile stuff that is pumped my way if I was on Twitter.
I don't manage your accounts.
That's true.
I guess a lot of people realize you're not running it, but a lot of people think you are there. They'll message you. Thinking that you're sitting on your Instagram replying to messages. And I'm like, I always say, I'm Talal, by the way, I'm not Alexi.
Right.
If I respond to someone.
Which is hardly considering, it's not really suffering, but, you know, there was an attempt. I think it was an initial, it would have gone further. There was, when I did Desert Island Discs in 2021, there was an attempt by a conservative cretin called Matthew Alford MP, who's now lost his seat. Obviously, I suppose at the behest of the campaign against anti-Semitism, which of course is a campaign for Israel, campaign for apartheid and ethnic cleansing. To have my Desert Island Discs not broadcast because I allow anti-Semitism for. Yeah, God knows, various number of reasons, and that, you know, the backlash was so strong, in support of me that they backed off really, because they saw that I was kind of fireproof in that. At that point, I was kind of fireproof that I'm one of the few people that they can't go after really. Mm. And it's a very privileged, you know, I've worked very hard to build in that position really, you know, and you always have to think about what you say and what you do. But, you know, I've always had that consideration in mind with all the things I do that they are going to come after me one way. But I feel a great kind of sympathy for younger performers, really. You must have a, you know, about whether to speak out or whether not. I mean, it's like sometimes, like Kneecap, it's made them arena acts. It's increased their, you know, one of them might go to jail. But, I mean, you know, it's increased their profile massively. Others, you know, there's a lot of comedians. Again, UK Liars for Israel and other groups, they act against comedians, particularly, I think, because comedians are the kind of conscience. And so you've got Reginald D. Hunter, who's going through a kind of a legal tussle with what's that shitbag, Martin Lewis's brother, Mark Lewis. And they go for comedians. They deliberately go and see comedians and then storm out outraged and then try and get them cancelled. There's a thing going on at Liverpool Unity Theatre about them. They're very conscious about attacking comedians, I think, because we do act as a kind of conscience. I also think that a lot of comedians are being utterly cowardly, though. I think that they should speak out more. I'm particularly ones who position themselves on the left. If you're, you know, I mean, it's not my original quote, but if you wonder about how you would have behaved during the Nazi Holocaust, how you are behaving now is how you would have behaved then. And if you stay silent during
this, you're siding with the power.
You'd stay silent during the Nazi Holocaust. So, you know, you have to reflect on that, you know, and whatever penalties you suffer, you know, your moral, you know, the country and the world needs you to speak out, really. So I think there is a lot. There's intimidation, and I understand that, and it's, you know, I'm sympathetic. There's also moral cowardice, really. Kind of shocks me, really. And it's easy for me because I say it's always been a part of my brand that I speak out, but I've never, they don't ask me to review the papers anymore on Radio 4 on Sunday morning. That opportunity seems to have mysteriously
gone.
Managed. And there was the thing that happened, I don't know, is because there was 500 Jewish people were handing a letter into Downing Street, which they wouldn't take. He's such a coward, he wouldn't even take the fucking letter. But, we were interviewed by some TV crew for politics. I was scheduled to go on the PM program, and then I was interviewed by a TV crew for Politics Live, and then PM and came back and said, well, we can't have you on because Politics Live have interviewed you, so we're cancelling your PM. And then it turned out that Politics Live is not on at the moment. So it's like, what's up with that? What's going on with that? You know, you were on the media round, really. They don't ask me, really. I can put myself forward, I guess.
Yeah, we did have a lot of the BBC cancelling us, though, I have to say. They contact us a lot when we were in Gaza and say, we want to do this interview with you. And, you know, you'd move the operating list around so that somebody else could do a case while you stepped out to do an interview. And then when you stepped out, they'd say, oh, no, you've been on BBC Radio this morning, so we don't want you.
Yeah. that's a kind of trick, I think, that they pull. Yeah.
But, and I think Philip, who was running my sort of contacting everyone with all the stuff, the videos that I'd recorded, he worked out that they did that to us about 9 times when we were in Gaza. They cancelled an interview
Yeah.
Do you get any horrible messages or anything from individuals?
I've had some letters from members of staff come to the hospital, but probably only 3 or 4. I had a really interesting conversation with a chap on Instagram, a Jewish guy, and, you know, he was quite anti-me, and I was a Hamas mouthpiece, and that was his opening gambit. And then we sort of, you know, I replied and tried to state my corner. And then he just suddenly came out and said, you've just got no idea what it's like for Jewish people in the UK. You can't, you know, basically, if you say you support Palestine, you're a self-hating Jew. And if you try and support Israel, you're a genocidal maniac. And so a lot of them, he was, you know, what he was trying to say to me is, you know, by spurting everything I'm spurting is inciting problems for, you know, the Jewish population, which is, you know, I do listen to what people say. It's a difficult one, isn't it? But I think it's hard. I do think it's hard. I've got a very devout Jewish friend, and I know she finds it hard. And when I first went to Gaza, we, you know, she was just very grateful that I came back and I was alive and I was okay. But we did have a conversation at the start of the war where we both said, look, we probably shouldn't get into it because we'll have different viewpoints. But now I feel it's gone so far that, you know, we probably should get into it because I know that she's not the sort of person that would support this because she's, you know, she's not.
Yeah. I mean, Jewish people need to have those honest conversations in their community. Really. But I mean, obviously the community pressure, I'm not part of the Jewish community. Well, I'm a part of a Jewish community, which is pugnacious old Jews who hate Israel and hate genocide. I mean, that's my Jewish community. Yeah. Well, some of them Holocaust survivors with weird beards. A lot of them have kind of strange, kind of slightly Baroque facial hair. I mean, the men. You know, just cantankerous old Jews who are so kind of morally, you know, strong in a way. But, yeah, you know, that's my Jewish community. So that makes it easy for me. I know if you're a part of that, like, you know, Golders Green or Manchester, you know, kind of,
yeah,
you know, kind of Israel supporting Ashkenazi, you know, it must be difficult, but you know, you can't.
Especially as we do have idiots who are anti-Zionist, and they do conflate that with being anti anyone Jewish, and you do have that minority, that
very tiny minority, I think.
You know, there are anti-Semites out there that you have to fucking,
oh yeah, there are.
So what do you ignore them, or like, just, we can't apologize for them because that gives us responsibility for them. You know, it's like they're not humanitarian. These are just hateful people. Like, fuck.
No, exactly. Exactly. And I think that's the way that we've navigated it, really, as the charities, is just to stick to the humanitarian issues. It doesn't matter who you are or what your religion is, watching, you know, 117,000 people be maimed and 60,000 die isn't acceptable in any religion.
No, it doesn't matter if you're going to, you know, people are going to say things to you at your son's bar mitzvah, tough shit, I think. What's your dog called?
Well, he's not mine. He's my, oh, right. I'm borrowing this dog. My dog's at home, but this is Fletch. He's not really supposed to be on the bed, but I'm a real pushover.
Says you borrowed a support animal.
Yeah, no, I had to leave mine at home because he's not got a passport now and he's a bit old. So I'm borrowing this one while I'm here. But he's good, this one. We're in Barcelona.
Oh, right. Oh, okay. Yeah. Young Ones was big in Catalonia.
Was it?
Yeah, bizarrely, because it was the first thing broadcast when they got their own Catalan language station. One of the first things that were broadcast was the Young Ones dubbed into Catalan. There's actually a statue. There's a statue of Nigel Planer in somewhere in some town south of Boston, some Catalan town. I can never remember its name. And we went to, me and Nigel went to a conference there.
Brilliant.
A few years ago, I was at a festival called Primera Persona, and so.
Oh, well, I'm we. We're going into Barcelona itself at the weekend before we come back, and I'm desperately trying to find those escalators that they've painted in the Palestinian flag.
No, I didn't know anything about that. No.
There's some escalators in the city, and they've painted the floor in the Palestinian flag colours.
They're very good.
Yeah, they are. They're very good.
Isn't it extraordinarily hot there? I mean, you know, it must be.
Well, I think it's probably not far off what it is in London at the moment, looking at the forecast.
Well,
aircon though.
You're on your oldies. You're not.
No, this is my. Well, it's not even a week because we only got it yesterday. But yeah, this is our holiday.
those stairs are in Park Güell.
Oh, I know Park Güell. Wilf's here now. Wilf, shut up.
No, let Wilf fly free. He's all good. Hello, Wilf.
See now, cat.
Oh, I should get Fletcher. Oh, Fletcher's left.
All right, it's a fucking zoo in here.
He's got a lot to say.
Yeah, well, his mind's going. He doesn't quite know, you know, where he is or what's going on, really. But we're only keeping him alive because the community of the podcast loves him so much, really. Oh, you poor old fellow. Oh. He's better now. He's seen me. He's calmed down.
Oh,
dear. Coming on wasn't a disappointment for you.
No, it was brilliant. You're an absolute legend. I'm that young one's age group. So I grew up on that.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
Really appreciate your time.
Yeah. Yes,
and if I could just waste a little bit more of your time, I do need to let the listeners know that to support the show, they can go to patreon.com/AlexisHellPodcast. That's patreon.com/AlexisHellPodcast. Chuck us a couple quid a month to help keep the show going, keep the show afloat. This is all grassroots movement. We never want to have adverts on the show, and you help us do that. All right, I got that out of the way. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Real pleasure, Doctor. Keep up the
thanks
good
work. Thanks very much.
What happens now?
Say bye to our listeners, Alexi.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkuti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.